I think that what we did last time can be summed up in a couple of equations. So we have for either a plasma in a non-expanding universe, or more generally, a plasma in an adiabatic expanding universe. The energy density, number density, and pressure can be written. I'll write down all three equations with one formula this way. So this integral is counting the number of particles, and then the number of particles per unit volume. And then I put in a factor of EQ, if I'm interested in total energy, 1 for number density, and Q squared over 3 EQ for pressure, which I didn't derive, but the derivation is in the Bauman notes. It's not supposed to be obvious. And then we worked out the, in an expanding universe, the dependence of the temperature on the scale factor. And that can be summarized by entropy conservation that says that the entropy per co-moving volume, SA cubed, where S is the entropy per physical volume, there's several ways to get this expression for the entropy density, and they all involve a little bit of algebra. I don't really know a quick way of seeing this. So now I want to just write down some consequences. First, maybe I should ask if there are any questions since last time. I've been doing a lot of calculations in a row, so I want to make sure that everything's clear. So before talking about the consequences of this, especially the cosmic neutrino background, I'm just going to introduce a little more notation. So a lot of the time, instead of rho appearing in equations, you'll see a quantity called G star, which is just a normalized version of rho. So it's defined by, let me call it G star of T. So it's defined by writing rho this way, or equivalently, G star is defined. The reason that definition is convenient is that if you take the expression that we wrote down above for the energy density and work out its relativistic and non-relativistic limits, and then convert to G star by putting in these factors, then a relativistic boson contributes 1. Contributes G, where G would be 2, for example, for the photon. 7/8 times the number of spin degrees of freedom G for a relativistic fermion. And I'll just write exponentially suppressed for a non-relativistic particle. So in larger, expressions, it can be more convenient to work with G star than with rho. Because you can quickly deduce what the value is by just adding up the degrees of freedom. G star is like energy density and units of a relativistic boson. And then analogously, there's an analogous definition with the energy density replaced by the entropy density. here the notation is G star S. So if I write the entropy density, I'm skipping a little bit of algebra here, but if I take this expression for the entropy density and plug in the explicit expressions for rho and p, and then do a little algebra, you can write the entropy density this way. It's a factor of 2 pi squared over 45. There is t cubed. Or equivalently. Where g star s. So at this level of detail, it looks the same. I get G for a relativistic boson. 7/8 G for a relativistic fermion. And exponentially suppressed if non-relativistic. But they're not exactly the same function of t. They're a little different when a particle is transitioning from relativistic to non-relativistic. The details of the exponentially suppressed function differ in the relativistic and non-relativistic cases. So I'll distinguish them notationally. But if you're just sort of if you're just counting degrees of freedom, then the counting works the same. Okay, and then entropy conservation. Using this notation, G star S, entropy conservation. SA cubed equals constant. Can be written as G star S A cubed T cubed is constant. Or T is proportional to G star S to the minus 1/3 A to the minus 1. And so this will let us read off. Last time I had a plot on the board, where I claimed that if I plot A and T on log axes, that the temperature for a plasma of positrons, electrons, and photons, that the temperature initially goes as 1 over A, and then has a little feature from heating, and then continues as 1 over A, where the feature occurs when the temperature is the electron mass, 0.5 MeV. And another statement that you can make about the feature is that if you compare the long-run behavior of the temperature to what you would have had without the feature, that they differ by a factor of 11/4 to the 1/3. To read off that behavior from this expression, I'll just notice that I'll work out G star S in the limits where the temperature is above the electron mass and below the electron mass, respectively. So when the temperature is above the electron mass, G star S, every particle is in its relativistic limit. So I just count degrees of freedom with a factor of 7/8 for fermions. So I get 2 for the photon, since that's a relativistic boson with 2 spin degrees of freedom. 2 times 7/8 for the electron, a relativistic fermion with 2 degrees of freedom. 2 times 7/8 for the positron, which added together gives 11/2. If the temperature is much lower than the electron mass, then I just get two for the photon. The electron and the positron abundances are exponentially suppressed. It's easiest to sort of draw a picture from here. If I were to plot G star S as a function of T, then it would start at 11 halves and decrease to 2, where the transition occurs when the temperature is the electron mass. G star S has a step-like feature of fractional size 11/4. If I make this plot by starting with a 1 over a, and then dividing by G star S to the 1/3, if I divide 1 over a by this function to the 1/3, then I get a step of size 11/4 to the 1/3. Okay. Now, I think what's sort of counterintuitive about all this is that it has a observational consequence. This heating event at MeV temperatures, which you would think would be totally thermally washed out today, has an observable consequence. Let me just sort of draw a picture, and then I'll justify these statements shortly. What I've plotted here is the temperature of the plasma. It turns out that neutrinos, so far I haven't talked about neutrinos, but they're part of the plasma, they're in thermal contact with the plasma. Until the temperature, when the temperature is above an MeV or so, after that time, they lose thermal contact with the plasma. Their interaction rate gets small. Neutrinos are no longer a thermal species. They just free stream on FRWG at S6. The neutrino temperature, I'll define properly what I mean by that, continues as 1 over A. It doesn't get boosted by this heating event, the annihilation of positrons and electrons. That energy just goes into the photons, and there's no interaction with the neutrinos. So the neutrino temperature stays down here, and the plasma temperature, a factor of 4/11 to the 1/3 below the plasma temperature. As the universe expands all the way from MeV temperatures to today, when the neutrinos are what we observe as the cosmic neutrino background, and the photons are what we observe as the cosmic microwave background. I'll put T gamma here for the photon temperature. So this picture predicts the ratio between the neutrino and photon temperatures is a constant value. Because the C and B temperature is something that we can observe today, we can predict the neutrino temperature. Let me start justifying all those hand-waving statements. The first thing I want to justify is the existence of a neutrino freeze-out, a temperature around 1 MeV, above which the neutrinos are strongly coupled to the thermal plasma, and below which the neutrinos are not interacting with the thermal plasma. To do that, I'm going to compare. I'm going to start by computing the neutrino interaction rate. This calculation is happening at temperatures of around an MeV, where what I mean by interaction is interaction with the plasma. Maybe I should draw a diagram. The kinds of interactions that I'm talking about would be a neutrino interacting with, say, an electron in the thermal plasma. by exchanging an electroweak particle, a Z boson. So I'll calculate the number of interactions per neutrino per unit time. And then I want to compare that rate to something, and I'm going to compare it to the Hubble expansion rate. Intuitively, if the interaction rate is much larger than the expansion rate, then the reactions that restore thermal equilibrium to the neutrinos happen faster than the expansion of the universe, and the neutrinos stay in thermal equilibrium with the plasma as the universe expands. So the neutrinos are thermal. And then in the opposite limit, the expansion of the universe is a fast process compared to the interactions of the neutrinos with other species. And so I can treat the neutrinos as just free streaming on FRW GS6 as the universe expands. In fact, when we actually get the form of the interaction rate, neutrinos are decoupled. I.e., each neutrino just free streams on an FRW geodesic using the rule that we derived earlier, that the physical momentum, the number of neutrinos is conserved. And the physical momentum of each neutrino just scales as 1 over A. That's a complete description of that's all the physics that you need to know to work out what happens to the neutrinos after free streaming. Okay. So to compute gamma, I'll need one piece of particle physics input. Since this is just the back of the envelope calculation with the twiddles everywhere, then the only thing from particle physics that I need to know is that the cross section for this diagram, interaction rates for processes with two input particles are usually parameterized by a cross section. Goes as some constant G Fermi squared times T squared, where G Fermi is the electroweak scale. G Fermi in more of a QFT language is the square of the coupling constant. For this vertex over the mass of the Z boson, just to say a little bit about where that comes from. The mass of the Z boson squared. And this cross section is the leading behavior when the temperature is small compared to the electroweak scale, which will be the case for us because we're at an MeV and the electroweak scale is more like 10 or 100 GeV. Okay. So to just taking this piece of input, this piece of information as an input to the calculation, then the interaction rate maybe Mina or Junru will derive this in detail in the particle physics class. So this is the neutrino interaction rate. And that can be written as, so this is the interaction rate for a single neutrino moving through a plasma of electrons. And so the interaction rate that a single neutrino experiences is the would be the electron number density times the cross section times the neutrino velocity. And then to work these out at Schwittle level, so for NE, I'm going to just replace this by T cubed. And that follows from our detailed expression for the number density of a thermal species. When the particle is relativistic, if its temperature is larger than its rest mass, and dropping order one factors. In the last lecture, I wrote down the order one factors, which are a little different for a boson or a fermion, and there's a factor of G in there. And then for the sigma, I'll put G Fermi squared T cubed, T squared. And then the neutrino velocities are always of order one, since neutrino masses are much less than an MeV. And then for the Hubble expansion rate, at Schwittle level, I want to write that as, I'd like to relate this back to the temperatures. I'm writing everything in terms of temperature, which tends to be the most convenient time coordinate when when thinking about the thermal history at these early times. So to relate H back to the temperature, I'll relate H to rho by Friedmann's equation, the one half here. And then I'll relate rho to I'll relate rho to T. I'm also going to replace, in this particle physics context, I like to write G in terms of the Planck mass. So the Planck mass is a pi G to the minus one half. And so I'll just write this factor of G as m Planck to the minus two. And then for rho, so I'll just rho twiddle t to the fourth. We actually have a notation now for the constant that appears, since we know that G star is of order one, rho is always of order t to the fourth. So putting these together, let me write a. This is t squared over m. And so putting these together, lambda over h, or the number of interactions when the universe increases in fractional size by a factor of e, can be written as G Fermi squared m Planck t cubed. And so you can see that the neutrinos are thermal. If and only if this quantity is larger than one, which happens if T is above some neutrino freeze-out temperature T star, defined by G Fermi to the minus two-thirds. You could write this as the electroweak mass to the four-thirds times m Planck to the minus one-third. Just as a comment on this calculation, since the physics is electroweak, you might think that then that the only scale is the electroweak scale, and that the neutrinos would need to freeze out somewhere near 100 GeV. You can also write this as the electroweak mass to the 4/3 times the Planck mass to the -1/3. The Planck mass gets smuggled into the calculation through Friedmann's equation. And so then that's of order 10^-5 GeV to the -2 times 2/3 times 10 to the 18 GeV to the -1/3, which is around 1 MeV. Forgot to say over here when I introduced the Planck mass that it's of order 10 to the 18 GeV. For what I'll do next, it's really important that the neutrinos freeze out here at an MeV, at a temperature well above the electron mass, rather than, say, 0.2 MeV, a temperature well below the electron mass. I feel that it's sort of cheating to conclude that based on this calculation, since like the answer did come out 1 MeV. But I dropped order 1 factors all over the place. Like, we don't really know if this is 1 MeV or 1 over 4 pi MeV. So let me just comment that I'm taking this number more seriously than I have a right to. I think the first time this back of the envelope calculation was done, it must have been regarded as inconclusive and needing a more detailed calculation. The more detailed calculation has been done, and it turns out that the freeze-out temperature is around 0.8 MeV, and that the neutrino decoupling occurs fairly rapidly, so that it's mostly complete, something like 99% complete by the time the electrons start annihilating. Getting that 0.8 and the statement about rapid decoupling, like, really gets into really requires getting into the weeds and like computing diagrams and summing up all the different electroweak diagrams that contribute, and is actually a really long calculation. All you can really say from at back of the envelope level is to justify the statement that the neutrino freeze-out occurs somewhere around here. Another thing you can show, by the way, is that since the T cubed is pretty rapid, like the interaction rate drops pretty rapidly, is that after this time, the total number of interactions that a neutrino will experience for the entire future history of the universe is much less than one. So the neutrinos are really extremely frozen out and don't interact with the plasma at all. So now I want to define what I mean by neutrino statement, by neutrino temperature, and justify that the statement that the neutrino temperature always falls as 1 over A after decoupling. So I'm going to view this as a calculation of the neutrino occupation number. So this is the quantity that I called F cubed before. I just want to denote the time dependence explicitly. And so I'm going to make the approximation that the neutrinos instantaneously decouple at temperature T star. And then just follow FRWG at S6 after that. So this will, at times below T star, this occupation number, is not, there's no reason it would have the thermal form. At decoupling, we're assuming neutrinos are thermal. And so we can write this equation. If I set A to the decoupling time, then it should be T star plus one, with the plus sign because the neutrino is a fermion. And then I'll go ahead and approximate that as e to the q over t star plus one. Since this equation applies at decoupling, where the temperature is much larger than the neutrino mass, and the neutrinos are relativistic. The same equation would be true at any time before decoupling. And then after decoupling, neutrinos free stream with a momentum proportional to 1 over a. And so that lets you write so this equation encodes that statement. There are no there's no physics operating, no interactions, and all that's happening as time evolves is that the same neutrino that was labeled with momentum q at an early time is labeled by some redshifted momentum at a later time. Then the occupation number or number of particles at a given q mode at time a can be inferred by blue shifting the momentum q back to the time a star and then counting the number of particles or occupation number at that time. So this is really the key equation that would apply generally for any free streaming particle. Such as CMB photons today that are after the CMB is formed that don't interact much. Okay. And so then plugging in the form of the thermal form of the neutrino occupation number at the decoupling time A star, I can write the result this way. So that's usually written this way. Let's revert to the F sub Q notation. E to the q over t nu plus one, where t nu is defined to be the decoupling temperature t star times c star over a, which whose time dependence is proportional to 1 over a by definition. Okay, and so this is a non-thermal distribution for two reasons. One reason is that the temperature which appears is not strictly related to the plasma temperature. It's equal to the plasma temperature at decoupling, and then redshifts is 1 over a forever. And so that justifies this picture where the neutrino temperature, because the neutrinos decouple here, neutrinos don't receive this factor, this heating factor of 11/4 to the 1/3, and are below the photon temperature of that factor. You'll notice that if the neutrinos decoupled here, then their temperature would be equal to the CMB temperature. And if they had decoupled earlier, like there's, so there's another heating event, the next heating event is around 100 MeV. When muons and pions annihilate. And so if the neutrino interaction had been even weaker and the neutrinos had decoupled at an even earlier time, then we would have ended up with a lower neutrino temperature, CNB temperature today relative to the photon temperature. The second reason why this is a non-thermal distribution is that the Q dependence is e to the Q over T nu rather than e to the EQ over T nu. So they have different. If you were to plot, for example, the energy density versus the neutrino temperature, then this distribution would behave differently than a thermal distribution. Let me make the comment that the energy density is always equal to this integral over FQ. We worked out some expressions for rho in the relativistic and non-relativistic limits. These are the relativistic and non-relativistic limits expressed in the variable g star instead of rho. Those statements would apply for a thermal species, but not to the to the CNB. So here's a visual way of thinking about the difference. If I vary the neutrino temperature and plot rho, then for a free streaming occupation function, what will happen is that rho will go as t to the minus 4 until the neutrino temperature equals the neutrino mass. And then it will soften slightly to t to the minus 3. Whereas for a thermal species, so this is for the real CNB, whereas for a thermal species, what would happen is you get the same behavior when the neutrino is relativistic, but then it would start to exponentially annihilate if it were thermal. And intuitively, the reasons, so you'll show something like this in your homework. Intuitively, the reason for this is that if I have a bunch of free streaming neutrinos with no interactions, then they behave as radiation, like FRW radiation, when they're relativistic. And their energy density goes as a to the minus 4. Sorry, there shouldn't be no minuses here. There should be 2 to the 4th and t cubed. And then when the neutrino, when a free streaming species becomes non-relativistic, then it behaves as matter. The energy density goes as a to the minus 3, or equivalently t cubed. Another calculation that you can do with this distribution function is to compute the energy density of the neutrinos today, expressed in this variable omega nu, the total energy density of neutrinos relative to the total density of the universe. And that turns out to be each neutrino contributes in proportion to its mass. If it were thermal, then the abundance would be exponentially suppressed in the mass, with a denominator that turns out to be about 46 eV. So what's interesting about the calculation is that the energy scale in the denominator here is so small. Even a 1 eV neutrino affects the expansion history and other cosmological observables at the level of like 10% because there are three species. And so you might guess that because cosmology is really sensitive to neutrino mass. And so you might guess that because cosmology measurements generally are at like 1% measurements nowadays, as a general hand-waving statement, that cosmology would be sensitive to neutrino masses on the order of 0.1 eV. And that is at order of magnitude level what the current observational bound is. So the current bound, mostly from the CMB, at present, the observations are consistent with zero neutrino mass, although I'll explain shortly that we know that the neutrino masses can't be zero, with an upper bound of around 120 MeV at 95% confidence level. To put this number in context, I'll just write down briefly some complementary constraints from neutrino oscillation experiments, from particle physics experiments. So there are neutrino oscillation experiments that measure the so-called flavor oscillations. If you emit a neutrino of one flavor, like say an electron neutrino in one location, and let it propagate like through the Earth to a detector in a mine somewhere, then you may detect it as a different flavor on the other end, and that flavor changing has an oscillatory behavior with distance that's related to the mass squared differences of species. So we know that there are three neutrino masses, and we know what their splittings are. So there's a small splitting it this way. It's the mass squared difference that's measured, not the mass difference. So you'll usually find it written this way, but I'll also write it with a square taken out. And there's this. Just So we know that there's a sort of a small splitting on the order of 10 millielectron volts, and then a larger splitting on the order of 50 millielectron volts. It's not known like which order they go in. So if this is neutrino mass, let's say the lightest neutrino has zero mass, then one possibility is that the small splitting occurs first. So there'd be one that was like here, around China, maybe. And then one around 50 MeV. And then another possibility is that the big splitting occurs first, so that the second lightest neutrino is at 50 MeV. And then the next one is like a little larger. Let's call it 50 plus epsilon milli electron volts. So this one is called the normal hierarchy of neutrino masses. And the second possibility is called the inverted hierarchy. Both possibilities are currently allowed by the data. One thing that I think is really fun is that the neutrino oscillation experiments have been around for a while, and they're very sensitive to differences of neutrino masses, or more accurately, mass squared. But they're insensitive to the overall neutrino mass scale. If I add a constant to every m squared, then the neutrino oscillation experiments can't tell the difference. And the cosmology is complementary. The cosmology gives a really good measurement of the overall neutrino mass scale, or more accurately, the sum of the masses, but is really insensitive to the individual species that contribute to that sum. By the way, the current best non-cosmological bound on neutrino mass. Is so it's usually quoted as something like 0.7 EV for a single species, which would imply that the sum of the neutrino masses, to put it in the same variable as the cosmological constraints, is around 2.1 EV, and it's 90%. Both of these constraints, this is from the Catrin experiment. Both of these constraints, the cosmological upper bound and the particle physics upper bound, will get a lot better in the next few years. Since the cosmological bound is only about a factor of two away from the guaranteed minimum neutrino mass from the oscillation experiments, I think detection of the overall neutrino mass scale from cosmology isn't too far away. And in particular, it could settle the question of whether a cosmological detection could settle the question of whether the neutrino hierarchy is normal or inverted. In the normal hierarchy, the minimum sum of neutrino masses is around 50 MeV. And in the inverted case, it's around 100 MeV, which is already, sort of in two sigma tension with the data. So if the error bar here got a factor of a few better and was still consistent with zero, then it could rule out the inverted hierarchy. Okay. That's all I had to say about about cosmic neutrinos. Next I was going to shift topics a bit and talk about dark matter and in particular the observational evidence for cold dark matter and then in particular the possibility that cold dark matter is another particle like the neutrino that froze out early in the early universe and has been free streaming to today, another so-called thermal relic. But since there's only 5 minutes left, this is kind of a natural place to pause. The next lecture won't be for like 10 days. It'll be tough for all of us to go 10 days without this beautiful cosmology, but we'll make it. In the meantime, does would anyone like to ask a question? Yes.
So, if I remember correctly, you said that the cosmic neutrino background hasn't been directly measured. We measure the CMB and we get the measurements of the CNB later, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I didn't really do a good job of explaining where that measurement comes from. The CMB is so when you measure the power spectrum of the CMB or the statistical size of like hot and cold spots of a certain angular size, then that tells you a lot about the plasma physics when the CMB was formed. It can do a really good job of telling the difference between standard model particles and cold dark matter, because they affect the plasma physics quite a bit. The standard model particles interact with photons, and the cold dark matter does not. Even though cold dark matter and other types of non-relativistic matter are degenerate in the expansion history. What's really hard to explain is how you've probably seen a plot of the CMB power spectrum, which is a series of bumps with a certain shape, and there's a lot of information there, like the heights of the peaks relative to each other, and the angular scale where the peaks occur, and the rate of fall off out here. What would really take a lot of time to explain is how those characteristic scales of the CMB are related to the stress energy contents of the plasma. But it does turn out to be the case that if you change the so at early times when the CMB is formed, the neutrinos are a large contributor to the stress energy. During radiation domination, the stress energy of the universe is dominated by photons and neutrinos, and they have comparable energy densities. And so it turns out that if you change the energy density of the neutrinos, either by changing the number of neutrino species away from 3, or changing the CNB temperature away from 1.95 Kelvin, then it makes a big difference in the location of these peaks. The neutrino temperature is measured to a few percent, but yeah, it's quick. You can quote it as a constraint on the CNB temperature today, but there's This was the way I wrote it down before. This is 1.94. It's important to say what the physics assumptions that go into this statement are. So what's really constrained by the CMB is the energy density of at early times, say between when the temperature is roughly in this range. This is when the CMB power spectrum is formed by sound waves propagating in the plasma. So what's really constrained is just the total energy density in radiation during this time. And then if I add the assumption that that energy density is just the CMB, just the photons, the CMB photons that I do understand, plus some neutrinos whose, plus some standard model neutrinos whose radiation density is, now I can write it down properly with all the constants. It's going to be pi squared over 30 times a factor of 7/8 because the neutrino is a fermion. With a factor of 6, because there are 3 neutrino species with 2 spin degrees of freedom each, times t to the fourth. Then the CMB inferred constraint on the radiation density at early times translates to this constraint on the CNB temperature today.
Okay, so it's more like the CNB appears as constraints through the CMB rather than observing neutrinos at certain energies I don't know, in different parts of the universe.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So the neutrinos here are really just being observed gravitationally, because they're a large fraction of the stress energy at early times. And they interact gravitationally with photons and pull plasma perturbations around. They turn out, it would take a lot of developing a lot of physics to describe it in detail. If you vary this energy density, it does things like move peaks around. One loophole in this is that if there were some other species of particle around that was relativistic at these times, then it would contribute to the energy density at early times. And then it would bias your inferred value of the CNB temperature if you plugged into this equation, assuming that the neutrino is the only species. Another comment is that, so we're really assuming that this energy density is all in neutrinos. But that's a reasonable default assumption because the temperature you get matches perfectly with the theory. There's no observation, as far as I know, that really, a neutrino means something specific, like a specific particle that interacts with the Standard Model through electroweak interactions. And as far as I know, there's no observation that is really shown directly that this energy, we know that this energy density is around at early times, but there's no observation that has shown directly that it's it consists of neutrinos. There are experiments that are trying, like there are projects to build neutrino detectors on Earth that would be sensitive enough to detect the cosmic neutrinos. Apparently, it's very, this is getting outside of my expertise, but apparently it's very challenging. And the reason it's challenging is just that the energies are so low. Like these neutrinos today have kinetic energies on the order of a milli electron volt. Or the neutrino temp more accurately, the neutrino temperature is on the order of a milli electron volt. Even though the neutrinos are around in great abundance, their energies are so small that they interact very weakly with the detectors.
Okay, and so I wanted to ask if the same anisotropies that affect the CMB, but no, I think I understand better.
You're wondering if
Yeah, because initially I was expecting a similar picture, peaks in the power spectrum for cosmic neutrinos, and I wanted to ask if the causes are the same or different. But if we are inferring the CNB through the CMB, then yes, it's the same thing.
Oh, right. That's an interesting question. So the CMB can be observed with great precision. We see the we have no problem collecting the individual photons, we can just beyond detecting that it's there, we can dig down and measure things like this, which are really faint signals. This power spectrum is a statement about the anisotropy of the CMB, which is sort of 10 to the five orders of magnitude smaller than just the existence of the background. Like the background's mostly uniform and has 10 to the minus 5 level anisotropy. So the CMB was first detected in 1960, but a really precise measurement of this power spectrum took a lot longer. It's really getting into the realm of science fiction, but in theory, you could imagine the same thing happening with the cosmic neutrino background. So far, we've never detected a single cosmic neutrino. If we do that and then we develop detectors that were 10 to the 5 times more sensitive, then the cosmic neutrino background, would show some angular power spectrum that would tell you something about the plasma before the neutrinos decoupled. I'm not sure if that I'm not sure how worked out that theory is. I don't actually know offhand if you can find papers that compute the power spectrum of the angular power spectrum of the cosmic neutrino background. Just because the observational prospects are so ultra futuristic. But it's kind of an interesting question, I think. What be a fun theory question, what you could infer about cosmology if you could measure it. I don't know if anyone's really worked that out.
Unless there aren't any other questions, like maybe as a follow-up, since you mentioned that it's very challenging to measure the cosmic neutrino background, so do you think we'll first be able to see a gravitational wave background or the cosmic neutrino?
Oh yeah, are you referring to the gravitational wave background from inflation? Oh right, so there may be a stochastic background of gravitational waves on cosmological scales, like scales on the order of 100 megaparsecs from the early universe. The issue there is so unlike the cosmic neutrino background. Where there's like a really well-defined theory target. For the case of cosmological gravity waves, we're in the situation where, some really natural seeming models of the early universe predict that those gravitational waves are present, and others don't. Like it really just depends on the physics of the universe that we don't really understand yet. So one thing you can say is that the current observational constraints will get a lot better in the near future. Like I think the error bar on those on that gravitational wave background is going to shrink faster than the error bar on the cosmic on direct detection of the cosmic neutrino background. There's no natural theory target. It's sort of a fishing expedition. Like we don't really know whether we'll see something or not. If we did see something, it would really narrow down the landscape of possibilities for the physics of the early universe a lot. It would point to inflation as being the correct theory, it would tell us that inflation occurred at a very high energy scale, at something like the grand unification scale. Those are statements that I'm just saying with hand waving for now, but we'll actually prove those statements in the last part of the class. That the gravitational wave background, the cosmological gravitational wave background, I'll say what it is. And then there'll be a relation between the strength of that background and the energy scale of inflation. Yes.
I wonder, so after the neutrino decoupling, why does the energy density proportional to T to the cube? That's because of the expansion rate?
So this is a statement that oh yeah right so I didn't prove this but I'll comment that you can prove it if you take this form of the occupation function and then compute rho using this integral so for any function FQ representing the mean occupation number, the energy density will be given by this integral. But you'll get different answers depending on the form of FQ. If I assume, and so this plot was comparing what you would get if you used a thermal FQ. This expression versus a free streaming FQ, this expression. You'll find that they agree in the relativistic limit, but in the non-relativistic limit, you get really different behavior. I didn't really show that, it will follow if you write down this integral and take the non-relativistic limit, kind of the way we did in a similar calculation in the last class. I think the answer makes intuitive sense because for a collection of free streaming particles with no interactions, the evolution of the stress energy has nothing really to do with the particles and just has to do with the FRW geometry. We argued when we talked about the FRW metric that for a relativistic species, the energy density should decrease as A to the minus 4, or equivalently temperature to the fourth. And for a non-relativistic species, the energy density should decrease as A to the minus 3, or temperature cubed. We didn't really show that before. Now that we're armed with these integrals and explicit formulas, you can work it out and show that that's true.